echoing his pronunciation as closely as possible. If I add the character... Speak! We practically shout as he writes the character next to Dian. I get... Telephone! If I add the characters for vision and sowing seeds to Dian, I get... Television! And what if I write shadow next to Dian? I get... Electric shadow! Movie! We don't have electricity. And we don't have telephones, television, or movies either. Until today, I really and truly didn't believe they might actually exist. They had only been exciting things to hear about, and much more fun than doing our math tables or identifying the countries around us that none of us have ever seen, will ever see, or can even imagine. Today, though, I understand just how sneaky Teacher Zhang is. He's made us beg him to teach us Mandarin. Or maybe he's tricky, which is why he was sent here in the first place and will never be allowed to return home. I hope so, anyway, because I never want him to leave. I need him. I run outside with the other kids, but I watch for Teacher Zhang to emerge from the classroom with his usual jar filled with hot water. Once he's settled on his own bamboo platform to eat his lunch, I walk over to him, reach into my pocket, and hand him a pinch of tea processed from last grade leaves. Help me, Teacher Zhang. Help me. Naturally, Abba and my brothers are against extra schooling for me.
What husband wants a wife who thinks she's smarter than he is?
Abba asks Teacher Zhang when he presents the idea, while Amma looks at him as though he has plague pustules.
Abba, I will learn wife and mother responsibilities, I volunteer. I'll continue to be a good daughter and help with tea picking. I won't miss a single chore or duty. If I do, even if it happens for the length of a swallow's blink, I promise I'll put away my books forever.
No.
A half cycle later, Teacher Zhang goes around my father's back and invites the headman, Ruma, and Nima to our house to consult.
The only education the girl needs is from her mother, the headman says. A time will come when we will require a new midwife.
I will learn those duties, I pledge. And I will, too, because I don't see a way for my plan to work otherwise.
That said, I won't meet Amma's eyes for fear she'll see the truth in my heart. I can never be a midwife. The headman, Ruma, and Nima glance at my Abba to get his reaction.
I have already said no, he says.
The village leaders seem willing to accept the father's decision about his daughter. But then Teacher Zhang starts rudely picking at the wound of inferiority we all carry.
I've lived many years among you, he says, and I can tell you this. Your people have no regard for education. You would rather let your children gather food, hunt, and nap than study. You boast of the Akka having one mind, but that mind is shy, closed, and suspicious. In this way, you ethnic minorities are all alike.
Embarrassed, the headman decides Teacher Zhang has hit upon a good idea.
She will bring honor to our village and inspire other children.
But the others remain silent in their opposition.
To you, this meager girl is just another mouth to feed until she marries out, Teacher Zhang persists. But if you let her continue her studies, she may help you one day.
He mulls over the possibilities.
What if the government decides you need a village cadre as you did during the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution? Those were dark days, were they not? Wouldn't you prefer to have someone from Springwell speak on your behalf?
When the Nima comes out of his trance, he says,
Let her go to second-level school, and later third-level school, if she qualifies. She'll become fluent in Mandarin. In later years, she'll be able to communicate with Han-majority people. And if they decide we need a village cadre to watch over us again, we'll present her as our candidate,
the Ruma adds, also agreeing with Teacher Zhang.
sun and moon, so I can take the blame and accept all the heat if the people of Springwell Village don't obey the government's orders? Or did the Ruma go along with the plan because I would be easily manipulated and controlled as a girl? Even Abba saw that those men were looking out more for their own welfare than for mine.
No, he said, which was remarkable given that the headman, Ruma, and Nima were united.
In the end, though, their interests were more important than rules for girls, and Abba was only one man with too many powers against him. Teacher Zong and I had won. For the next 2 years, I worked very hard, doing home chores, picking tea, following and learning from Ama, attending school, and working privately with Teacher Zong to improve my math skills. I take and pass the test that will allow me to go to second-level school. The headmen, Ruma and Nima, call the village together to announce the news and present Abba with a pouch of tobacco as praise for being such a far-sighted father. Teacher Zong gives me a copy of one of Lu Shun's books.
So you'll know our greatest writer.
Months later, when the new session opens, I walk alone to the second-level school. I'm very scared. I'm 12 years old and still quite small. Entering the schoolyard, I hear many different languages. Dai, Yi, Lahu, Hani, Nashi, and Mandarin. I don't catch a single word of Aka. Only when I get into my classroom and we're assigned seats, something I've never experienced before, and I'm put in the back corner, do I discover another Aka. I recognize him right away. San Pa, the pancake stealer. Part 2. A Beautiful Flower Calls. 1994 to 1996. A Blind Kitten. Each year, in the month of Chola Ba La, which is similar to what the Han majority calls the eighth lunar month, and what I now know the rest of the world calls September, we have the Swing Festival. The four-day celebration always begins on Buffalo Day, exactly 9 full cycles, 108 days, after the Ruma has told the people of his particular village to plant their rice. The festival has yet another purpose, beyond the sacred Thanksgiving, and that is for boys and girls of marriageable age to meet. For this reason, some people call the Swing Festival the Women's New Year, because it can be the beginning of life for us. This year, I turned 16, and now the women in my family have gathered to help me put on my headdress for the first time. When you reach 12 years, you discard your child's cap so you might wear a simple scarf, Ama begins. 2 years later, you tied a beaded sash around your waist, which hung down and kept your skirt from flying up. She motions to third sister-in-law, who holds up my headdress. It's decorated with dyed chicken feathers, monkey fur edging, colorful woolen pom-poms, and silver coins, balls, and pendants that Ama and others have given me over the years. The effort you've put into this will show your future husband and his family your meticulousness, willingness to do hard work, and knowledge of the Aka's path of migration through embroidered symbols, third sister-in-law says, proud of her teaching. It will also announce your artistic sensibilities, which you can pass on in the unfortunate event that one day you give birth to a daughter. She hands the headdress to Ama, who gently ties it over my hair. 5 kilos was a lot lighter in my lap than it is on my head, and my neck wobbles a bit. You have now received the gift of womanhood, Ama says. The sisters-in-law smile, and my nieces stare at me enviously. When I look in the mirror, I see a thin but pretty girl. My eyes are wide and shaped like leaves. My nose comes to a delicate point, unlike the mashed noses of Han majority women. My cheeks are tawny from the sun and mountain air. I am most definitely ready for marriage. I wish I could run outside this instant to see if the boy I secretly love has come, but the ceremony isn't over.
As promised, Amma continues, you've never missed a single chore or duty. You thresh rice and grind it under the house every morning. You haul water. You work as hard as your brothers during tea-picking season. Her voice trails off. This is to make me remember all the time we've spent on my useless land, tending to the mother and sister trees. Instead, I think about all the classwork I completed, aided by Teacher Zhang's ongoing tutoring, and how I learned never to talk to my family about what I'd been taught. I made that mistake early on when I told Amma and Abba that a lunar eclipse was not caused by a spirit dog eating the moon, and that Burma was now called Myanmar. You can now make potions, First Sister-in-law says. You gave my daughter tea leaves to place over her pimples so they disappear quickly. And you gave them to me to reduce the circles under my eyes, Second Sister-in-law adds. My husband benefited from the wild tobacco you told him to chew to help with his toothaches, and now he uses the gooey residue left in his pipe to kill leeches just as you recommended. You know the proper opium dosages to give to the dying, Third Sister-in-law says in awe. And you've even learned how to extract and then boil the stomach contents of a porcupine to give to someone who is unable to stop vomiting. Amma holds up a hand to silence the others. Most important, you have learned the skill of delivering babies. It's true. When that mother in Bamboo Forest Village gave birth to a stillborn, I made sure that the tragedy was buried in the forest. The next year, she had a second stillborn. Tradition says that this child is the first baby returning. I instructed the father to throw the corpse in water to break the cycle of returning. The next year, the couple had a perfect baby boy. In other villages, I saw three human rejects come into and leave the world. One had a head double the normal size. One was too small, and the last had a particular look that Amma said marked him as a future idiot. Never once have you faltered, Amma says. But what changes Amma and I have seen since the birth of Sido and Deja's human rejects. I now understand that I live in an area so remote that we didn't hear about the one-child policy for almost 15 years. When the family planning office finally opened at the tea collection center, it was only for Han majority workers because this policy doesn't affect any ethnic minority anywhere in the country. However, if a Han woman gets pregnant with a second child, she'll be made to abort it and pay a fine. If she continues her reckless behavior, she'll be sterilized. But this talk of midwifery isn't just to praise me. It's the prelude to the warning every girl who puts on her headdress for the first time is given by her Amma. Today, across the country, babies have a value they never had before, and we Akka get to have them, she says. Even multiple litters of twins if we want. Our Ruma and Nima have accepted this, with sly male satisfaction, because this is the one thing we have better than the Han majority. When she says, it is a shame this change didn't occur sooner. I know she's speaking of the one terrible time twins were born in our village. Then she adds, as if to comfort me, fortunately, our leaders were quick to embrace change. Other villages, well, it can be hard abandoning something you've done and believed in for generations. She pauses to let me absorb her words. Then, no matter what, though, we, like Han majority people, would not condone the birth of a baby if the mother was unmarried. Everyone knows that having a child without a husband is taboo. This is one of our traditions that makes no sense. Boys and girls are encouraged to do the intercourse before marriage, but a girl is forbidden to come to a head. No matter. I'm too smart to let the second part happen to me. I've read novels and studied history, math, and science. Together, they have taught me the importance of independent thinking, watching out for my body, and looking to the future. You are a woman now, Amma says, and the others nod their heads at the solemnity of the moment. Just then,
From outside, I hear Sitae call my name.
May I leave?
I ask Ama. It's an abrupt end to the ceremony, but what else is left to say? I'm shoot out the door with Ama calling,
This is a big day for both of you!
Sitae waits for me at the bottom of the stairs. I'd like to tell her she looks beautiful in her headdress and festival clothing, but we Aka never use that word to describe another human.
All the boys will want to take you to the flower room when they see you, I say in greeting.
The flower room? I've already done that, she giggles. I'd rather go to the forest to steal love. The question is, when are you going to the flower room?
I blush. Just the idea of meeting alone with a boy without our parents?
Of course,
she continues casually but knowing the effect her words will have on me.
If he comes, you might want to take him straight into the forest. There's nothing to it, you know. You need to stop behaving like a blind kitten and act your age. Otherwise, you'll never get married.
Some boys and girls, like my friend, have been going into the forest to steal love since they were 12. Not me. My free time was taken up with homework and studying. Over time, my seat in school was moved forward until I sat in the front row. Sunpa also began to move forward, reaching the middle of the room. In another 2 years, we'll take the Gaokao, the countrywide test, to see if we'll be allowed to continue our education at a first, second, third, or fourth tier university or college. If we fail, we won't have a chance to take it again. If we make it, we'll be the first members of any mountain tribe on our mountain to be granted higher education. Then we'll get married, have as many children as we want, and be a part of all the changes that are still to come to our prefecture. I'm not sure when I fell in love with Sampa. A week ago, when he teased me about wanting to see me in my headdress? A year ago, when I helped him for hours with his algebra homework? Or maybe 6 years ago, when he gave me a bite of that pancake? We have spent so much time together these past few years as the only Aka in our class. Together we studied the history of other countries beyond those that abut our borders but are still similar to China in outlook. Russia, North Korea, and Cuba. Together we struggled through the great Chinese novels, Dream of the Red Chamber and Rickshaw Boy, as well as those written by our Russian friends, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. We've talked and talked, and we've spent hours together, just walking, partway to and from our first and second level schools. He's always been interested in what I have to say, and I've loved hearing about his hunting expeditions with his Aba and other men in his village. I've been able to help him with his essays, and he's always shown his appreciation by bringing me a little treat plucked from the jungle, a blossom, a necklace of woven vine, or an egg from a nest. If Sanpa asks me to go to the flower room or the forest, I'll go, I confide to Sitae in a whisper. People in the next village can probably hear her laughter. Although we no longer spend the entire day together as we did when we were in Teacher Zhang's class, Sitae and I are still as close as two girls can be.
If you don't like it with him, then steal love with another of the boys who'll be here during the festival, she says when she's caught her breath. You can do it as long as he isn't in your clan.
Stealing love with Sampa won't be for me like it is for you and...
Boys try out girls. Girls try out boys, Sitae continues right over me. If they both like the intercourse, then the boy will ask for marriage. If the girl comes to a head by mistake, then they will either get married or the girl will visit your Ama for one of her special potions. If neither of them likes the intercourse... Then why would they want to spend the rest of their lives together? Then it's only right to look elsewhere.
I'm not of a mind to sample every pumpkin in the market. I only want Sampa. Until we become village elders, until we die, forever into the afterworld. My admission sends Sitae into another spiral of giggles. We climb a series of paths to a clearing that overlooks the village. Some men have already taken down the old swing, while others watch over a pit where pieces of a sacrificed ox turn on a spit. I look for Sampa in the crowd, but there are so many people. Women barter homemade brooms, embroideries, or dried wild mushrooms for silver beads and other trimmings for their headdresses. Men trade home-cured hides for iron
to give to the village blacksmith to hone into blades for machetes and axe heads.
Sitae and I are the only girls in our village who've put on our headdresses for the first time, and boys look us over like goats to be traded.
Sitae pulls on my sleeve.
When the time comes, and it will, you let him make a way down there first. It will still hurt, but it will hurt less. He's probably stolen love before. He'll know what to do.
Before I have a chance to ask what make a way means, whoops and hollers cut through the air as a throng of young men emerge from the forest with four thin tree trunks stripped of their bark.
One member of the pack carries over his arm loops of magic vine.
Sampa!
I'm accustomed to seeing him in school in unadorned leggings and tunic, but today he's dressed as a man who wants to announce to everyone what a good family he's from. His mother has dipped the cloth of his shorts and jacket in indigo dye many times to get a deep and very rich color. Even from afar, I can see that his jacket is built of many layers. And his mother, or sisters, or both, have stitched his belt with five bands of intricate embroidery. Instead of a turban, he wears a cap, sheathed with silver cutouts hammered into the shapes of acanthus leaves.
Look at him! Sitae sighs dramatically. He's definitely come to look for a wife. He's come for you. Why else would he walk so far? Why else would he join the boys from our village in going to the forest for the vine and to cut the trees? Hours on mountain paths and he still looks so...
Man beautiful, I finish for her.
Beautiful?
Sitae covers her mouth to hide her giggles.
He spots me. He doesn't pretend indifference. His mouth spreads into a wide grin, and he begins threading his way through the crowd toward Sitae and me.
She clamps her mouth shut, but I can feel her excitement. He stops a meter in front of us. His eyes shine like black pebbles washed by the rain.
You have a nice village, he says, but I look forward to the day when you come to mine. It's bigger, and we're on the crest of a hill, and not in a saddle.
His meaning could not be clearer. He's telling me he'll make a good husband because his village is better, wealthier, and easier to defend than mine.
I blush so deeply that I'm sure I've turned the color of mulberry juice, which is so embarrassing that I feel my face burn even worse.
Fortunately, the Ruma arrives in the clearing. The swing won't go up until tomorrow, so this part of the ceremony will be short. The Ruma starts his ritual chanting, but we don't fully understand what comes out of his mouth. Our culture was built over many centuries by ancestors who lived on the earth before us. How they pronounced their words, 100 or 1,000 years ago, is only for the Ruma to know. By the time he's done, I'm ready to have a proper conversation.
May I show you my village? I ask.
It feels natural to walk by Sampa's side, pointing out who lives where, and telling little stories about our neighbors. He takes it all in, asking questions that in all the years we've known each other we've never discussed.
How many brothers do you have? He inquires. How many sisters? How many cousins live in the main house?
I ask him the same questions, and follow up with, how many newlywed huts does your family have?
I'm the only son, he answers. My three sisters have already married out.
So his Ama and Aba will welcome a daughter-in-law, be happy to build a newlywed hut, and eagerly await the sound of grandchildren in the main house.
I'll visit my sister's villages on my way home, he goes on, since I've been so busy figuring in my head.
You're not leaving tonight, are you? I stammer.
If you'd like, I could stay for the entire festival.
I'd like that very much, and another rush of blood floods my face. We circle the village and return to the swing clearing where everyone has gathered around a bonfire for the feast. Sanpa joins the other unmarried boys, and I sit with my family. Our eyes keep meeting. Our silent communication is so deep that it feels as though we are the only two people here. The music, singing, and dancing begin immediately after the meal. Someone hands Sanpa a drum, and he joins the other men as they dance, illuminated by the firelight. His body rises and falls with each beat of the drum.
The warmth I feel comes not from the fire or my blushing cheeks, but from below my waist. For the first time, my body fully understands why boys and girls want to go to the forest to steal love.
The next morning, everyone gathers again in the clearing, where the Ruma supervises the men as the four poles for the new swing are put in place, then tilted inward until they meet at the top. A man of small stature shimmies up one of the poles and secures them together. He then fastens a long length of vine to the top, letting the looped end hang down in the center of the pyramid. Last, the Ruma makes offerings to appease earth spirits and protect us from any accidents.
"I am Ama and Abba to Springwell Village," he chants. "Like a mother hen, I protect those under my wing. Like the father water buffalo, I protect them with my horns."
He grabs the vine, walks up the hill, and places his left foot in the loop. Then, accompanied by cheers, he careens down between the poles and out into the air over the edge that overlooks the village. Next, every male, from eldest to youngest, takes a turn. Finally, we girls get our chance. For reasons of modesty, a board is strung through the foothold for us to sit on. When my turn comes, Sitae and third sister-in-law give me a push, and then I'm flying down between the poles and up and out into space. The wind rushes through my headdress. The bells and other silver ornaments jingle. The chicken feathers flutter. The silver on my breastplate catches the sun. I'm a soaring bird for Sanpa, and I can't stop smiling and laughing as I pass back and forth over his head. He returns my smiles and laughs. Later that night, after another feast, I take Sanpa to the flower room. Some boys and girls have already paired off. I don't spot a private place for the two of us, but that doesn't matter. Our parents aren't watching, so we can do whatever we want. When Sanpa pulls me into his arms, we both seem to know what to do. His lips are gentle on mine. With a moan that I've only heard coming from a newlywed hut, he buries his face in my neck and kisses me again and again. I feel like I can barely stand. The next morning, as Ama and I grind grain beneath the house, she asks, "Who were you with last night? Was it La Ba?" Ama and Abba have always liked La Ba, who lives in Bamboo Forest Village. We went to the same primary school, and my parents have always hoped I'd marry him. He wears glasses with big black rims that make him look like an owl, but with none of an owl's intelligence, and I've never once thought about visiting the flower room with him. I keep my head bent to the millstone, hoping she'll think of something else to talk about, but she's an Ama, and it's her duty to be nosy.
"Was it the stranger boy I saw gazing at you?" she persists.
"I guess so," I answer, when I know perfectly well it was Sanpa.
"But isn't he the one who stole the pancake all those years ago?"
She doesn't chide me for taking him to the flower room. Instead, she cuts straight to the heart of the problem.
"He was born on a tiger day. You were born on a pig day. That will never change. Your Abba and I will never agree to a marriage."
"But I love Sanpa."
"You love Sanpa?"
His name comes off her tongue like a bitter herb.
"What you are doing is an irresponsible act of tempting fate."
"But I'm not going to give up. Not ever."
"He will be a good husband. His family is better than ours. We are both educated."
"None of that matters now, and you know it. There is no purpose to this visit," she states with finality. "You will need to find another boy."
Hours later, after more swinging and feasting, I let Sanpa lead me into the forest. The world shimmers with life around us, the fragrance of flowers, earth, and wild animals, the sounds of frogs and incessant song, animals howling in their mating, and the caws of birds who stare down at us with reflective eyes. The air itself bathes our skin with its warm breath. We walk until we find ground cushioned with leaves and pine needles softened by the passing of seasons. We sit side by side, staring out at a range of mountains that bank away from us, becoming more and more shrouded with mist, humidity, and distance until they melt into the blue-gray sky.
"Are you sure you want to do this?"
he asks.
"I'm sure."
We turn to each other. He kisses me as he slowly lowers me to the ground. He fumbles with my clothes. His calloused hands tell me that he works hard for his family. He squeezes one of my nipples, and a foreign-sounding yip escapes from my lips. I haven't practiced with other boys, but I yearn to touch the flesh beneath his tunic. His chest is smooth. His muscles are firm under my palms. He pulls up my skirt, reaches above my leggings, and touches the part of me that has become slick and wet. But he's the one who moans. He stares into my eyes. I see all the way to his soul. Whatever he has between his legs has to find what I have between mine. I may not have done this before, but I've seen roosters mount the females of their species. Pigs, dogs, and cats, too. Sanpa helps me flip over until I'm on my hands and knees. Something hot and hard slaps against my rear end. I arch my back at the feel of his fingers. I'm so happy for Zite's advice, because he's making a way exactly as he should.
Sanpa!
His name is an ocean in my mouth, carrying me to a place I never knew existed. His hands come to rest on my hips. Then that hot thing back there finds my entrance and begins to push. I push back.
Wah!
Such pain, like the blacksmith's poker stabbing me. I collapse to my elbows, and we both hold completely still. He leans down over me, putting his mouth close to my ear.
Should I continue?
I take a breath and nod. Slowly, slowly, he moves back and forth. The startling pain is gone, but I don't feel anything close to the urgency I felt before. Sanpa does, though, and he picks up his rhythm, just as I've seen all those male animals do. When he's done, he falls onto his back next to me, hiding the hot thing under his tunic before I get a chance to see it.
"Next time, it will be better," he says. "I promise."
He kisses me and smooths my skirt down my legs.
"Will you stay the night with me?"
When I nod, he wraps his arms around me, pulling me to his chest. I close my eyes and listen to his heartbeat.
"I was an unmarried girl, too, once," Ama comments when I arrive home the next morning. "Just remember, today is a day of ceremonial abstinence for the entire village. That means..."
"I know what that means," I retort. "What I'm thinking, though, is that my sore parts will have a chance to heal."
"You were supposed to be different with your school and your plans. None of that has changed."
She doesn't believe me.
"You're no different than any other girl on this mountain. Stupid with love."
She sighs and goes back to her grain grinding.
"It may be a day of ceremonial abstinence. The requirement that we must be careful with our arms and legs has new meaning to me. But Sanpa and I go to the forest anyway.
Just to talk," he says.
We return to the spot where we did the intercourse. We sit, and he tells me how he's loved me since he first saw me at the tea collection center. He couldn't say anything to make me happier. And he couldn't do anything to make me happier than when he reaches into his pocket and gives me the eye of a peacock feather.
"For your headdress," he says.
"How did you get it?" I ask.
He juts his chin. "It's enough for you to know that I found something that might bring you joy."
Our future is clear. Now that he's given me a gift, all that's left is for his parents to send emissaries to ask my Ama and Abba if he can take me to his village in marriage. We'll graduate, go to university, join the market economy. The following week, I'm surprised to discover Teacher Zong in the schoolyard during lunch.
Rumors travel fast, and I suspect he's come to congratulate me. I'm wrong.
Are you sure marriage to this boy is what you want?
He asks.
You've worked so hard.
I try to be polite. You've been my greatest teacher.
What about the Gaokao?
Sanpa and I will take it together. Teacher Zong shakes his head sadly.
You know he'll never be invited to take the test. And even if by some miracle he is invited, he'll never pass while you have a future. You could be the first on this mountain to go to Ethnic Normal College, or maybe even Yunnan University.
You're wrong about Sanpa.
If you marry him, tradition will weigh on you, he insists. Your families will want you to stay home, have babies, and heal like your mother.
He hears what he's saying as a threat. But Sanpa will never let those things happen.
Tell me you won't stop studying, he persists.
I won't stop studying, I promise. I'll take the test, even if Sanpa doesn't. Teacher Zong nods his head three times, very sharply, and then shifts his shoulders within his jacket. With that, he leaves, going back to the primary school for his afternoon class. I look around the yard for Sanpa. I spot him sitting on a wall with some other boys, their legs dangling. I realize he's watched my exchange with Teacher Zong, but he doesn't cross the yard to ask me about it. I still love my family and do my chores obediently, and I still cherish Cité but reveal little to her of the dreams of the life I'll have with Sanpa. Cité, perhaps sensing this new and growing space between us, finds excuses for us to leave the village.
We're going to gather firewood. We'll be back soon.
So I can open my heart to her without fear of others eavesdropping. I understand her desire, because we've always shared everything. But even as Cité wants to hear every detail, I find myself hoarding them, speaking insignificantly about my emotions and skirting her questions by asking if her father has received any proposals since the swing festival. Her family is, once again, the richest on the mountain, having recovered from the setback caused by the sacrifices required to absolve and cleanse them of human rejects. As a result, Cité will go into marriage with many gifts. She tells me about this and that boy, but it doesn't make me any more forthcoming. My evasions must hurt her feelings, because she strikes out at me by saying,
"People say Sanpa still visits other girls in their village's flower rooms."
"I don't believe it," I tell her, and I don't. When she hints at names and places, I can come to only one conclusion. "Are you jealous?" I ask. She gives me a haughty look.
"Of what?"
"Of me. Because you visit the flower room and steal love in the forest with different boys, and none of them have asked to marry you."
"That's a mean thing to say, when I'm just trying to be your friend."
"Wow, don't you think it's mean to repeat gossip? And even if he does those things, what makes him any worse than you, or any other boy or girl on Nanuo Mountain who tries the intercourse? That's what we Aka are supposed to do before marriage." She remains silent for a long while. Finally, she asks, plainly and simply,
"Are you one of those girls who forgets her friends when she does the intercourse? I didn't forget you when I started doing it."
That I don't have an answer causes both of us anguish. But isn't this how it's always been between us, with one falling and the other rising? Sanpa comes often to Springwell Village. We've met in the flower room. We've gone into the forest. I went ahead and asked him about other girls, and he asked me about other boys. My answer? None. His response?
No other girls for me either.
I've come to enjoy the intercourse, and we've even done it not like animals but face to face. I like that especially, being able to look into his eyes, kissing his mouth, wrapping my legs around him. Afterward, when he walks home, I stay perched on our pine needle bed, and we sing call-and-response love songs across the hillsides. "The flowers bloom at their peaks, waiting for the butterflies to come. The honeycombs wait for the bees to make honey. A beautiful flower calls to her love,
The bee flies through the air to find her. He drinks her nectar. She holds him in her petals.
We sing the refrain in unison, letting all those who hear us know that our love is absolute.
Let us pick flowers together.
Aluse, ahi ahi o, ahi ahi o.
We are happy, but one thing has not changed since the pancake incident. As Ama reminds me, I was born on Pig Day, and Sun Pa was born on Tiger Day. This is not an auspicious match, so naturally our families are against a union. In the manner of all Aka fathers, Aba sends messages to me indirectly. First sister-in-law touches my shoulder and confides, "A weak boy grows up to be a weak man." Second sister-in-law is brusque, "The whole mountain knows he's lazy." Third sister-in-law, my favorite, mutters to me, "You won't have anything to eat if you marry that good-for-nothing." They can say whatever they want, but that doesn't make it so. Aba has allowed Sun Pa into the house, and the two of them have spoken. The situation for my family is better these days, which influences how the conversation proceeds. 3 years ago, my Aba was able to trade some of our extra rice for a young female pig. She grew up, was bred, and now we have 3 pigs sleeping under our floor. We'll never be as well off as Sitay's family, but Aba's improved status gives him the confidence to hold out for the best marriage proposal that will arrive for me. Sitting next to our home's dividing wall, I've been able to listen to the conversations between Sanpa and my Aba. Sanpa announces that he's come to fetch a wife, which is how Aka men refer to marriage.
"No," Aba says.
Sanpa recites his male ancestors back 50 generations.
"No," Aba says.
Sanpa points out that we don't have any matching ancestors for 7 generations, which means we've passed the incest taboo. But Aba doesn't care.
"No," he says, adding, "It is not yet time for my daughter to go work eat,"
which is the way Aka women look at marriage.
"My daughter plans to take the Gaokao and be the first on Nanua Mountain to go to college."
That's how much he doesn't like Sun Pa. 5 months later, the month of rest arrives. In the West, it would be considered comparable to February. Since the men don't have to work, they put their most formidable efforts into settling their marriage plans. Unmarried women spend their time weaving and waiting for proposals, which is why this month is sometimes called the month of marriage and weaving. So far, I've done plenty of weaving, but have seen no marriage arrangements made. During the last half of the second cycle, Sanpa comes to the house to ask yet again if we can be wed. He receives the usual answer,
"No."
"I will be a good husband."
"I don't think so."
Today, instead of the usual mismatched day argument, Aba goes in a different direction.
"You might think you live far away and that we would not hear about you, but we have heard. You've been trading in things you shouldn't and trying things you shouldn't. If you were as respectable as you claim, then your parents would have sent 2 elders from your village to ask for girl to become a daughter-in-law. They would have sent gifts. If we reached terms, then she would go to your home for a night, make sure she thought she could be happy, and 3 days later, the two of you would marry. None of that has happened, because they disapprove too. I remember your Aba, boy, and he was an honorable man. Even all those years ago, he was prepared to protect my daughter's reputation from the actions of his own son."
Sanpa has no way to defend himself. My father speaks again.
"The matter is finished."
Later, in the forest, I ask Sanpa what my Aba meant. "What does he think he's heard about you that puts you in such an inky light?" But Sanpa puts his mouth over mine, and we start conversing in other ways. That afternoon, we begin to make a plan.
"We'll move away together," I say. "We'll walk to Meng Hai."
We'll be married there, and no one will stop us.
He tucks escaped wisps of my hair back under the protection of my day-to-day headdress.
I am a man, he says. You are a woman. It is my duty to care for you. I will make the decision. You will stay here and take the Gaokao. I will leave Nanua Mountain to find work in one of the other countries where the Akaw roam.
But can't we stay together? I'll go with you. Laos is so close. Myanmar, too.
No.
His voice is surprisingly sharp.
It's not right. Your father would never forgive me. I will go to Thailand.
Does he decide on this country to remind me that he's in charge?
It's a long walk. Maybe 250 kilometers on a map, but much longer through the mountains. But what are the mountains to me? I'll make it in 10 days, maybe less. You keep studying and take the Gaokao.
When I return, with my pockets heavy with good fortune, I'll find you at your college. I'll join the market economy and make even more money. After you graduate, we'll ask a village where people don't know us if we might be allotted a piece of land. I'll farm, and you'll be a leader of women.
He stares into my eyes, surely seeking how deep my love is for him.
And will tell people I was born on a more compatible day.
We could never lie about the lineage.
We won't have to. I'm suggesting the change of just one word, from tiger to sheep. And from now on, that's what I'll claim when I meet someone new. It'll give us a fresh beginning.
I'm not sure this fabrication is a good idea, or that the false label will change the essence of who he is, but I consent to his plan. He will one day be my husband, and I will be his wife. I must learn to obey if we are to be happy.
He rips two thick threads from the hem of his tunic.
When going far away, strings must be tied around wrists.
I'll be tied to you, and you'll be tied to me.
He loops one of the threads around my wrist and makes a tight knot.
As I do the same for him, he continues,
"This proves we're human, because spirits don't have strings. I promise to come back with enough money to buy a rice farm and marry you, a girl I've known and loved since childhood. We're going to your Ama and Abba right now to tell them."
My entire family, all my brothers, sisters-in-law, nieces and nephews, and my parents, listen to us when we gather in the common room. There is a saying in the Han majority culture about a smiling face hiding bad intentions. That's what I see when I look at the faces that belong to my family. Their mouths say the correct words, but behind their tongues are deeper truths, and they permeate the room.
"Do you want to give up your opportunity to finish school and go to university?"
Abba asks Sampa, when what he really means is, "Go away and never come back."
"Your parents will be proud of you," Amma says, but her entire body radiates a message as strong as the sun. "You talk like a flying eagle, but your hands are like Chinese sour vegetables."
Meaning, he can talk big all he wants, but he'll forever be a pancake stealer in her eyes.
"This will change the direction of your story," Big Brother states,
although he could just as easily be saying,
"Once you leave here, you'll forget about my sister, so be it."
My family walks Sanpa to the village gate, which means that we don't have a chance for private goodbyes. Still, Sanpa says loud enough for everyone to hear,
"I promise to come for you, Lian."
He backs away, slowly, slowly, not for a second taking his eyes off me. I'm so blinded by tears that I don't see what's about to happen, and my family, curse them, doesn't call out to warn Sanpa until it's too late. Instead of passing cleanly through the spirit gate, he backs right into it. It's the worst omen possible and strictly taboo. Even Sanpa is startled and alarmed, so much so that he turns and bounds into the forest.
"I hope his parents perform cleansing rituals for him," Abba comments. "It doesn't matter. The damage has already been done, Ama says, barely hiding her contempt.
Come. We must visit the Ruma. We need to be cleansed.
The Greedy Eyes of a Tiger. The day after Sampa leaves, I visit Site. We sit on the floor and talk, as though my coolness towards her when Sampa was here never happened.
We are as jungle vines, she says, even though I've hurt her. Our roots will forever be entwined in friendship.
Our friendship will go on as far as the stars, I agree, and finally tell her everything about Sanpa. My friend doesn't warn me about him or criticize him. Instead, she closes her eyes and sighs. One day I'll be as happy as you.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could marry out to the same village, come to a head together, and help our children to be as close as we are?
I squeeze her hand and silently make the same wish, too. A few days later, we're catching up on our home chores before tea-picking season begins, when frightening noises come thundering from the forest. They grow louder and nearer. Small children cry into their mother's tunics. Elders quake on their sleeping mats. Dogs crawl under houses, too afraid to bark. The sounds are mechanical, but inconsistent, humming one moment, grinding the next. They abruptly end with a hideous cough. Everyone in our village must be inwardly thanking the Ruma for building a spirit gate so powerful it barred whatever the horrible thing is from entering Spring Well. No one ventures to the gate to investigate. But the birds begin to chirp again, and the dogs come out from their hiding places. A few minutes later, we hear a male voice call, in Mandarin.
Hello, hello, hello!
No one answers. The voice rings out again.
Hello, hello, hello! Is anyone here? Come out! Let us meet!
Again, the voice speaks Mandarin, but it sounds off, more melodious, as though he's singing. Still, the voice clearly belongs to a man and not a spirit. Even I can tell that.
Abba comes to the dividing wall. Girl, what is he saying?
After I translate for him, he says,
You'd better come with me, since you've learned the man's tongue.
I meet Abba outside, where the headman, Ruma, and a few other men have already gathered. They all hold their crossbows. As we near the spirit gate, I see a man, a boy, and a car. A car! Green, with a tin red star attached to the front. It's an old People's Liberation Army mountain vehicle, something I've seen in school posters commemorating the War of Liberation. The car door opens, and another man, who's been sitting behind the wheel, steps out. We stay on our side of the spirit gate. The visitors remain on their side of the gate. In the silence, a lot of surveying happens. The driver is dressed nearly identically to Teacher Zong. Blue pants and jacket, like every other non-minority man I've ever seen. But the other two are as odd as can be. The little boy is bald, for one thing, but his father quickly covers his head with a tiny cap with a big brim in front. The child's pants, bright yellow, are cut well above his knees. The tops of his shoes are made of cloth, but the bottoms look like bendable plastic. His shirt has short sleeves and hugs his body. No buttons or anything like that. Instead, a drawing of a yellow boy with hair that comes up in sharp spikes decorates the front. I try to pronounce the word that's been printed in Western letters coming out of the boy's mouth. Cowabunga. It's not a word I know. I step forward.
I'm guessing, young lady, that I must speak to your elders through you, the man says.
He strides straight through the gate. He must have been warned not to touch it, and extends his hand.
In Mandarin, my name is Huang Benyu, but I'm from Hong Kong.
So he's a native Cantonese speaker, which explains his accent and extra tones, but his Mandarin is much better than mine.
Hong Kong, I murmur. He could just as easily have said the moon.
This is my son,
he states, motioning for the boy to join him.
While we're on the mainland, we'll also use his Mandarin name, Xian Rong. He is 5 years old, and my only son. My only child.
I translate this information for the men around me. I feel that we must all be staring at the strangers in the same way, our mouths agape, our eyes wide. Apart from Teacher Zhang, none of us has met someone from outside our province, let alone from another country.
Hong Kong!
When no one says anything, he goes on.
I've come a long way to buy your tea. I'm a businessman. I make and supply cranes. China is in great need of those now.
Why are we in need of birds? No idea, but we listen anyway.
That is my vocation. My avocation is tea. I am a tea connoisseur.
Huang Sheng Sheng,
I say, using the Mandarin honorific for Mr. I don't know how to translate all of this. He throws back his head and laughs, exposing every single one of his teeth. The men around me edge back. I retreat even farther, wanting the protection of my Abba and brothers. From my secure position, I take a closer look at the stranger. His head is shaped like a turnip, plump, with vaguely purple cheeks. His hair is as black as lizard eyes. He's chubby, like the posters I've seen of Chairman Mao. I never believed those images were real, that anyone could look like that, so fat, with a belly sticking out. But the way the stranger's belt circles his middle, emphasizing all the food that must have gone to build it, almost makes me want to laugh. His pants have sharp creases down the front and back. The material doesn't resemble anything I've seen before. His short-sleeved shirt is crisp, also with sharp creases. The stranger regards us too, taking our measure, in the way a farmer might look into the mouth of a water buffalo. I don't think he likes what he sees, but I have an idea of what he is. Rich. Not well off like Cite's family, but something altogether different.
Is there a place where we can sit and talk?
He asks.
I'd like to sample your tea. Possibly buy some?
After I translate, most of the men scurry back to the village. They want no part of this. Only the headman, Ruma, and my Abba and brothers, who must safeguard me, remain. The men whisper among themselves. We Aka are known for our hospitality, but they question bringing the stranger into one of our homes. The headman makes the decision.
This girl speaks the stranger's language, and she has her clan to keep her from harm. We'll go to where she lives.
My brothers glare at me as though I've brought the worst disgrace possible upon the family. My father's eyes have the steely look they get when he guts a deer. They never approved of my education, and now it has placed the family in an uncomfortable position.
All I want to do is buy tea,
Mr. Huang reassures us in his unnerving, friendly voice.
You have tea here, don't you? Yes, let us drink tea.
As though we wouldn't offer it?
But made only with spring water. Do you have spring water?
What other kind of water is there? Rainwater? Creek water? Pond water? Our village is called Spring Well, I say.
He laughs again. Of course. That's why I chose your village to visit first.
We make a peculiar procession. The little boy skips ahead as though he knows where he's going. His Abba doesn't seem particularly worried. One of our neighbors must have alerted Amma and the sisters-in-law, because tea has already been brewed by the time we arrive. Once the men have seated themselves on the floor in the central room, the sisters-in-law are waved off. Amma stands with her back against the bamboo wall, her hands clasped before her, watchful. I stay at her side and translate when necessary. Abba gestures for the stranger to try First Brother's tea. But when he takes a sip, his face crinkles as though he's rinsed his mouth with unripe persimmon juice.
This must be terrace tea, from bushes,
Mr. Huang says.